This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Healthcare can be hard enough to get in rural America. Now it is getting harder with hospitals closing down. Nearly 100 rural hospitals have closed in the past decade. Another 600 are at risk. Many are in the 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid. But is expanding Medicaid the solution? Is it that simple? Or is something bigger happening? How are these hospital closures affecting conservative lawmakers who opposed Medicaid expansion in their states? Our new project, 1A Across America, headed to Fort Scott, Kansas, a town of about 8,000 people. Mercy Health System stopped running that town's hospital on New Year's Eve. Now the 171-bed facility sits mostly empty. Longtime resident Janice Fewins is a retired teacher. She gave 1A's James Morrison a tour of her town and the hospital.
If you need to move that seat back, you can. The adjustment's on the side.
Let's see. Good thing I'm short.
It's just an automatic, too. It'll push back automatically. Do you need more room?
No, this is fine.
Well, it'll be interesting for you to see the little town. We kind of struggled through that recession, that began in 2008. And things just start to build up. Then something will go out and we go, oh no, But this is, somebody came in just last year and really fixed that up. Put a new price chopper in, and it's only been there a year now. They're already leaving, and everybody's going, it's just like Mercy said they were closing, and then just a few months later, Price Chopper's closing. Now this is the big industry, is Peerless Products. They manufacture windows for commercial buildings, and they just added that large building back there. The old hospital was right up on that hill. And I think I told you the day before they were going to tear it down, the community came and formed a circle around it. Everybody held hands. We brought our kids to it because they were all three born there. We wanted them to remember where they were born because that was going to be gone.
Now, some doctors' offices will remain at Fort Scott's hospital. A private physical therapy company has moved in, and Mercy Health System says it will keep the emergency room open through this month. Janice Fewins says she's hopeful that city leaders will find a replacement hospital operator. She's a registered Republican who says she supports expanding Medicaid in Kansas.
We do still have our emergency services, thankfully. That was the first thing we all worried about, is what happens when something traumatic happens to us, so that's still going to be here, I believe. And then the doctor's offices are still going to be here.
And so it seems like there's still some operations going on outside of the emergency room here.
Yes.
But it's not nearly as much as used to go on.
Yes. Basically, what we're missing is, for instance, my husband had to have gallbladder surgery, and that comes on quickly. We could come in here and he had it within an hour or two of having the attack. That's going to be gone. Now if he had it, we'd have to get in an ambulance and drive 30 miles to get to a hospital. And us in particular, the doctor who did that is not here any longer, so we'd have to go and get a new doctor.
When was it that you learned that the hospital was going to close here?
Oh, I think it was right before Christmas.
So it was quick then. It was a month time frame. And so I know, like, a lot of the discussion around, like, the hospital's closing is that would expanding Medicaid help it out? Has there been any discussion of that, or do you think that would have helped the hospital?
It would have helped some, because I think it would have meant it's 2.1 million. Or something like that for this hospital a year. And that wouldn't have been enough to save it, they say, but it probably would have helped. And part of the Mercy said that the hospital wasn't being used enough. Well, it's underutilized because the people can't afford to come, the ones who would have qualified for the Medicare expansion would have been able to.
And I imagine you talked to a lot of people being around town, and have you seen the thinking evolve on that to maybe being opposed to the expansion and then now seeing the hospital closing and then now saying that, oh, this could actually be good for us?
Yes, and only thing I can talk about is just my group of friends that I go with. The majority of them could see that's something we should probably think about doing. So I think Kansans are figuring that out. Oh, I should have gone the other way to show you something else. It's not too late. We'll go this way on the way downtown.
That was Janice Fewins in Fort Scott, Kansas, speaking to 1A's James Morrison. Joining us in studio to discuss what's happening in Kansas and elsewhere is Sarah Jane Tribble. She's a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Sarah Jane, your reactions to what we just heard. You're a native Kansan, you were telling me earlier, right?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in southeastern Kansas, which is known as one of the most unhealthy parts of the state by any healthcare outcome measures, low income, higher uninsured rates than the rest of the state and so forth. I grew up in Parsons, Kansas. So when you fly into Kansas City, you drive down south, you pass through Fort Scott to get to my hometown.
Talk about the impact to a community when a rural hospital closes. We heard some of the things from Janice and what she's noticed, but what other kinds of impacts should we bear in mind?
Well, I think the biggest thing that you heard in Janice's tape is the idea of driving around town and looking at the big employers. Peerless is a Fort Scott employer. It's a big one, but it only has a few hundred employees. So that's the largest employer in town. Hospitals are often either the largest or second or third largest employer in a rural community. So that translates immediately into economic impact. There was a 2015 study that noted that on average, 99 jobs are lost. On average, about 5.3 million in salaries are lost. When a hospital closes, you see unemployment rates go up. There was a 2006 study that noted that unemployment rates went up 1.4% in these communities. That impact immediately because, you know, you see doctors moving out of town, you see lots of for sale signs on the houses, and then there's the trickle-down effect. She mentioned that Price Chopper is closing. Price Chopper may or may not be closing because the hospital's closing, but they weren't making enough money there, the revenues, and you see that happening across the country and across the state, and there's that impact. Then there's the emotional impact in these communities. When the hospital is the place where almost all the children are born in a family or all the children in a family are born, it has a very emotional connection for that family. And you almost always know somebody who's working at the hospital, who has been to the hospital.
Yeah.
It's kind of a foundation.
Sarah, why are these hospitals closing? Why is this happening?
Well, I think some of the factors are predictable, right? You have towns that are shrinking in size slowly. You have a loss of income from that. You also have a lower median income in many of these communities than in the urban counterparts. There's a larger elderly population as well. Then there's also some interesting trends that you might not expect. There's a term I learned a few weeks ago called out-migration. And that's when, and actually Janice mentioned this when she was speaking to James, they don't necessarily go to the hospital that much. So they'll bypass the local hospital because they know that in Kansas City there is an expert children's hospital. Or they'll go out to another hospital that's a critical access hospital that may have more services because they have some more surgeons or something. They may have orthopedics or cardiology that this other rural hospital that is near closing or about to close or has closed cut the services because they were trying to save money. So there's this out-migrating trend. There's also the trend of higher deductibles on insurance. I've talked to some people who say, you know, our deductibles went up to $2,500 and I just can't afford to go to the doctor anymore.
So you have hospitals in these communities that didn't have the kind of specialties that people were looking for with the robustness that people wanted. So they were kind of not even in the habit of going to these hospitals when it really counted.
Well, right.
Or for the big stuff, I should say.
Like in Fort Scott, you know, that hospital was rebuilt in 2002. They had 63 beds when they rebuilt. They then took the bed count down because people weren't going to the hospital. And in order to take that bed count down, then you remove specialties, right? So what you're seeing across the U.S., are specialties being removed because they're trying to save money.
We'll talk more about the politics of this in just a moment with Sarah Jane Tribble of Kaiser Health News. We'll add another voice to our conversation and we'll get some more of your voices in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI. REI believes that a life outdoors is a life well lived, and they have for 80 years. So check out their podcast, Wild Ideas Worth Living, for inspiring stories of people who took the road less traveled. Hear from explorers, athletes, authors, and experts in the field. Follow how they're taking wild ideas and making them a reality every day. Find it on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Sure, you listen to this podcast and all the other NPR podcasts because of how much stuff we know. But what about you? When do you get credit for how smart you are? Well, now you can. The Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me quiz game is now available via your smart speaker. Just ask your smart speaker to open the Wait, Wait quiz, and finally, recognition can be yours.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing a growing trend of hospital closures in rural America. S. Stone tweeted, "This was a known risk for states refusing to expand Medicare and the GOP's systematic dismantling of the Affordable Care Act. But those states voted red for the quote-unquote freedom to choose their health care plan. Elections have consequences." Before we bring one more voice into the conversation, Sarah Jane Tribble, I think S. Stone meant expanding Medicaid rather than Medicare, but can you briefly explain what that Medicaid expansion was?
Right. So Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act was to bring more people without insurance into the fold so that they could go to hospitals and get their health care. It increased up to 138% of the poverty level. Lots of people who earn in 2019, that'd be about $16,000 for a single person, about $34,000 for a family of four. And so if you were earning that much in certain states that expanded Medicaid, you could get on the rolls. Now, there's a crucial difference. I just want to mention, lots of people know it. Medicare is usually the service that the government provides, or health care coverage the government provides for people 65 and older or with disabilities. Medicaid is for people of low income.
Is there any evidence that expanding Medicaid would have prevented these hospitals from closing? What do we know? Or do we know?
Well, I was talking to one healthcare expert who covers rural America, and they said it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in a lot of these cases. But there have been trends over the years for decades of rural hospital closures, and the reasons for that. Those include sequestration, when the government did some budgetary manipulation. They cut Medicare funds. A lot of these rural hospitals are very dependent on Medicare funds as well. And there's some changes in the way they calculate bad debt when people don't pay their bills if they do have insurance. So this was sort of just adding to the pile.
Let's add one more local voice from Kansas who's been watching the politics of healthcare there. Joining us from our Across America partner station, KMUW Public Radio in Wichita, is Jim McLean. He's the chief political reporter for the Kansas News Service. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here. And Joshua, can I just say hi to Sarah? It turns out we're both from Parsons, Kansas.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Good to talk to you again.
What are the odds of that?
I don't know. How about that?
You know, public radio bringing people together every single day. Now, Jim, in our last segment, we heard from a woman in Fort Scott whose hospital recently closed. We reached out to the state representative who represents that area, Trevor Jacobs, and we asked him if expanding Medicaid would have prevented the hospital closing. Can I read you his statement and get your reaction? It's a little lengthy, but bear with me.
No,
so here's a statement from State Rep Trevor Jacobs, who represents Fort Scott. Quote, "In the business world and the natural world, Darwin and capitalism have the same equal outcomes. The strongest survive. It is not government's job to be in the business of keeping privately owned nonprofit hospitals open or afloat. Maybe if we the people weren't being raked across the coals by the pharmaceutical vendors, and if we the people were able to keep our once affordable insurance plans and keep our doctors, and we had more access to a fair market healthcare choices like we were promised almost a decade ago, then maybe, possibly, Fort Scott may still to this day have a hospital. Government expansion does not work, because at the end of the day, that's all it is. Government expansion, that does not work." Unquote. That statement from State Representative Trevor Jacobs, who represents Fort Scott, Kansas. Jim, what do you think?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. The senator who also represents Fort Scott is opposed to Medicaid expansion and quote-unquote government expansion into healthcare as well. Trevor represents, I think, a pretty distinct point of view in the Kansas legislature and in Kansas politics generally. Conservative Republicans really have held sway here in recent years. That is beginning to change in 2016 and then again in 2018 with the election of a Democratic governor. But the legislature is still pretty balkanized in terms of the political philosophies, which makes issues like Medicaid expansion very complicated, and that was a very complicated explanation of his position, I think.
Well, with regards to what the representative said, let me come back to Sarah Jane Tribble. The representative raises a good point. Healthcare is expensive. It's not getting cheaper anytime soon. Many conservative lawmakers argue that expanding Medicaid would kind of bust the budgets. We see some of the things that the representative wrote in his statement about pharmaceutical vendors and the cost of insurance plans and having what he called fair market healthcare choices. Is there any data from states that have expanded Medicaid to support Representative Jacobs's argument?
Yeah, there's a bit to unpack there. So if you're a state, a conservative state, and you're looking at your budgets, Medicaid costs a lot of money. It is a big number on your budget. And the idea of expanding it is just, it's almost too much to take. But in reality, what happened with the Affordable Care Act is the government said, we really want you to expand. We're going to give you money. We're going to give you lots of money, 100% that dials down to 90% of the funds for that expansion population. And it stays at 90% of the funds for that expansion population after 2020. And so you're not paying most of that out of your state budget. There's the federal government chipping in. So there's that factor. Now, there is the fear that, you know, that costs will go up for the state initially because people without insurance are going to run to the hospital and their doctors and get care. And there is some data showing that there is a slight increase in those costs. But the overall data shows that there's not a total increase in Medicaid spending, and there's not a significant increase in spending for the state for Medicaid.
So I just want to make sure we're clear. It may well have cost Kansas a lot of money, but Kansas never would have been paying all of that money because the federal government would have brought the money.
Right.
Kansas Patriot writes, like a mirage, the promise of new technology that brings medicine to the people in remote areas is always just over the horizon, and we never seem to get there. Will it happen someday? Probably, but for decades now, it seems, we've been tantalized with promises that never come to fruition. What about alternative ways of providing health care, whether it's telemedicine? Another one of our listeners asked about intermediate facilities, not quite the family doctor, not quite a full-blown hospital, but like, you know, emergency clinics and urgent care clinics, outpatient facilities. What about other ways of filling that gap?
There's a lot of conversation in hospital circles about new models of care for rural America. And what we're seeing is a bellwether shift in how healthcare is happening in America. So urban areas, we have hospitals, we have outpatient centers, we have lots of options for our healthcare. But in rural America, those are shrinking, obviously. And so Senator Grassley, for one, he reintroduced legislation in 2017, the REACH legislation, where he was saying, well, let's shift and put a new Medicare payment category that will pay hospitals for just having outpatient and emergency. They don't have to have inpatient beds. That's still out there somewhere. It's like a lot of bills out there floating. But there is talk about these new models of care, and I think these communities are really trying to say, what do we really need, and how can we get it?
Now, Jim, in the midterms last year, there were voters in Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah who approved ballot measures that ordered Republican officials to expand Medicaid. Is there any prospect of that in Kansas?
No, we don't have initiative and referendum here in Kansas. The legislature would have to put the question on the ballot, which is not likely to happen. So the decision on Medicaid expansion rests squarely with lawmakers.
And three Republican state lawmakers, as I understand it,
right,
recently left their party to join the Democrats, and all of them support expanding Medicaid. Are they more an exception? Are they the growing rule? I mean, how is this affecting politics in Kansas?
Yeah, politics in Kansas is changing. All three of those legislators are from Johnson County, which is a county right into the in the Kansas City suburbs. And they had been moderate Republicans for all, their entire careers and, as you mentioned, switched over and are now Democrats. That county is changing politically like many suburban areas are across the country. I should mention that an expansion bill did pass the legislature in 2017, but then Republican Governor Sam Brownback vetoed that bill. Of course, a veto is not a risk this session, but It's the legislature has changed ever so slightly since then, and Medicaid expansion advocates are fairly certain they can get a bill through the House if they can get it on the floor. The Senate is the question mark at the moment.
Jim McLean, a political reporter working with KMUW Public Radio in Wichita, Kansas, one of our 1A Across America partner stations. Jim, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
And Sarah Jane Tribble, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and another native Kansan. Sarah Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now, this week we've been discussing topics suggested by listeners. Today's subject won the healthcare category of topics by a whole lot. It got more than half the vote. Doug Hastings wanted to know, what would federal health care for everyone really cost? And how would our tax burdens change? Good question. with some complex answers. So joining us in studio is Dan Diamond. He covers healthcare policy and politics at Politico, and he's the host of the podcast Pulse Check. Dan, welcome back to 1A.
Glad to be here, Joshua.
We also welcome back Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a question kind of in two parts. What would it cost, and how, if at all, could we pay for it? Let's start with Doug's original question. What would federal health care for everyone really cost? Dan Diamond, let me start with you. What would it cost?
Well, it would cost trillions of dollars, Joshua, in new federal spending. The defenders of these plans say that the average taxpayer wouldn't feel that, though, because right now our spending is often hidden. There is money coming out of my paycheck, probably your paycheck, going towards our private health insurance that in this model would instead, we wouldn't have to pay that. There would be taxes added on. But the richest Americans would end up paying a lot more based on all analyses here. There would also be a cost cut that would be involved with paying hospitals and doctors. That gets overlooked a lot in this debate. But there are about 15 million Americans who work in healthcare in some respect. Plans like Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan would assume a 40% pay cut, basically overnight, in what these hospitals and doctors get paid. So cuts on the end there while new taxes coming in to prop up the plan.
Julie Rovner, trillions of dollars that would be offset. Is that your assessment of what it might cost?
Yes. And actually, very exciting to those of us health nerds is that we're going to know this according to the Congressional Budget Office, because the new chairman of the House Budget Committee has asked the Congressional Budget Office to estimate exactly how much it would cost and what would change. This may obviously take a couple of months. We're not going to get it anytime in the immediate future, but at least we will know, I think, in 2019, according to the official scorekeeper, how much this might cost. And obviously, as Dan said, there would be winners and losers. Some people would save lots of money. Some people might pay more. Everybody would pretty much pay more in taxes. It might not be as much as they're paying now for out-of-pocket medical spending and their health insurance premiums, but it would be a big disruption, and I think people are not really aware of how much of a disruption that might be.
So with regards to that second part of the question, how would the tax burdens change, Julie? It would go up for some, up more for others?
Yeah, well, it would depend partly how they finance it. Presumably, it would be a progressive type of financing where wealthier people would pay more, less wealthy people would pay less. But whether or not you end up spending more money depends how much you spend now. If you get free health insurance from your employer, which some people do, not that many anymore, you might end up paying more because then you would be paying taxes to basically subsidize the system. If you use a lot of health care, you might end up paying less because you'd probably have lower out-of-pocket costs. But it's worth remembering that most people don't use the health care system or don't use it to any large extent, and those people might actually end up paying more. But again, it depends on everybody's individual situations. That's the one truism about healthcare. No matter what you do, you create winners and losers get mad.
And Julie, when you say most people don't use the healthcare system in any major extent, you mean for things like surgery and inpatient care and long-term maternity care and that kind of thing?
Right. I think about half the public doesn't really interact with the healthcare system at all in any given year. Lots of people don't even go and get, basic preventive care. But, the top 5% of spenders in the healthcare system mm-hmm. spend half of the money that's spent on healthcare. It really is. It's an interesting chart. It actually hasn't changed that much over the years, that there are some very sick people who end up consuming most of the money.
So 5% pay about half the cost as it stands. Dan?
Well, I think there are two important caveats for this entire conversation, Joshua. One is that when we're talking about these plans, at least in the United States, we're dealing mostly with theory, not reality. And the estimates that are being produced can wildly vary based on which political group, which partisan interest is weighing in. So listeners might have seen different numbers here. I will say that there has been a very close study of a single-payer plan in New York State by an independent group called RAND. That group found that about 90% of taxpayers in New York State would end up paying about the same, if not less, toward their health care, but the rich would get soaked. The top 5% of high earners would end up paying more, a lot more, maybe $50,000 more per year towards subsidizing this plan for everyone.
Is that $50,000 sticker price, or if I was one of those people, would that be defrayed by whatever my insurance covered?
No, that would be $50,000 more out of your pocket every year, Joshua, in taxes and other fees.
Preventive care, dental checkups, eye tests, like that would all end up costing me $50,000
more? It wouldn't necessarily be for those tests specifically. You would be asked as a rich New Yorker to subsidize the cost of care for everyone else.
Much more to discuss with Dan Diamond of Politico and Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Hinge. Hinge is the dating app that's designed to be deleted. It's for people who want to get off dating apps. Show off your personality with icebreaker prompts and see who likes you so you can easily start a conversation. On Hinge, 3 out of 4 first dates lead to second dates. And they're the number one dating app mentioned in the New York Times wedding section. Download Hinge in the Apple Store or Google Play.
Before you can start your day, you like to know what's happening in the news. That's what Up First is for. It's the morning news podcast from NPR, the news you need to take on the day in just about 10 minutes. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation with Dan Diamond of Politico and Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News. Jean writes, let's have voluntary Medicare for all, just like Medicare now. Let insurance companies compete for supplemental coverage as needed or desired, and they could still compete to cover those not interested in Medicare for all. What's so complicated? Julie Rovner, what is so complicated about that?
This is the big fight in the Democratic Party. There is a general consensus that everybody should have access to affordable health insurance. That was the Affordable Care Act was supposed to be the first step towards that. The question is, how do you fill in those gaps? Do you, do something dramatic like Medicare for All that would get rid of private insurance? Do you let younger people into Medicare, those over age 55, maybe even those over age 50? Do you let people buy into Medicare on the individual market as a public option? There are a couple of suggestions to have a buy-in for Medicaid, which is a richer benefit package because it's for low-income people who don't have any money. There are all kinds of possibilities for how to do this. And the question is not so much how much would it cost, but, you know, how well would the system work? How fair would it be? How satisfied would people be with the kind of insurance that they would have and their ability to get to healthcare providers when they need to?
We should also be clear, Dan. And there's no drop-dead agreement on what a plan like this would cover, whether it would be more Medicare-like or more Medicaid-like, or whether it would be basically like the PPO that you can get from your boss. Whatever the floor would be for a plan like this is not a settled issue.
We are at the beginning of a multi-year legislative fight. I was just up on Capitol Hill yesterday talking to Representative Brian Higgins. He's a New York Democrat. He believes in one of these Medicare buy-in plans that Julie was just describing, that Americans over age 50 should be able to choose and pay in if they want to buy Medicare. But he also is a supporter of Medicare for All in the kind of traditional sense, where every American could get Medicare for All. The issue is getting Democrats to agree, and this president, President Trump, and the Republican Party that controls the Senate, they're not going to move anything on this issue. So this is really a lead up to what might happen in 2021.
Let's dig deeper into this idea of Medicare for All, Dan, because people tend to use the terms Medicare for All and single payer health care and a public option. Break those down. How do Medicare for All and single-payer health care, is that interchangeable? Is that the same thing?
They're not mutually exclusive. So single-payer basically is Medicare for All in the sense that there would be one government payer paying all the doctors, all the hospitals. We would all be buying into the same plan. That's what Bernie Sanders has in mind when he talks about Medicare for All. This is like the United Kingdom's National Health Service. But Medicare for All doesn't have to be single payer because these congressmen and others are pitching all these other options. Maybe it's voluntary. Maybe it's something that you pay a little bit for. Again, I'm betting you're covered by private insurance. I'm betting a lot of listeners are covered by private insurance. I mean, it's NPR, so maybe they're covered by their local yoga studio or commune. But point remains, there might be some other model that a lot of people like about
eating. What's wrong with my commune, Dan Diamond?
Well, I'm sure it's locally sourced and organic, but
damn,
which is
right.
Great. And you want to keep it. And that's kind of the approach that most Americans have.
So 8 in 10 commune.
80% of Americans like their current coverage, which means when they hear a pitch like Medicare for All, and I was just talking to a pollster this morning, Kaiser Family Foundation's Tricia Newman, she said most Americans say, yes, I support Medicare for All, but I want to keep what I have. And that's very different than single payer.
Can we clarify, Dan, what we mean by overusing healthcare? I mean, I do have private insurance. I work for WAMU, which produces 1A. WAMU is owned by American University, and so I'm an AU employee, and I have the PPO plan that comes from the university. I got to say, now that I have terrific coverage from the university and the means to go to the doctor when I want to go to the doctor, I kind of love going to the doctor. I got to say, it's nice to be able to say, oh, I haven't had my teeth cleaned in a while. I'm going to get my teeth cleaned today, this afternoon after the show.
So you're like, the problem.
I'm using healthcare. Like, I need healthcare. Oh, my back hurts. I think I should go to a physical therapist to see if I can get that fixed. I got this thing on my eye. I should go to an optometrist. That's what healthcare is for, isn't it? How does this debate turn into me as a person having to ration out my wellness, where I have to feel humbled by wanting to approach a doctor and say, I am sick. Can you make me well? Something about that feels backwards.
Well, the idea of overuse stems from how our system is set up. We have a fee-for-service healthcare system right now. Doctors, hospitals get paid the more they do, essentially. That has been changing. That has shifted. But it has created incentives to sometimes profit off of patients, referring them for things that they don't need, or when that worried well person comes in, maybe giving them something that that person doesn't need. But I do think the energy that is driving this, Joshua, is less about people who might be using healthcare and using it too much, and more about the millions of Americans, 30 million Americans who are uninsured, millions more who are underinsured, who have a lot of insecurity about, can I even go to the doctor because I'm worried about the bills that I'll get?
Marik tweets, would the medical professionals have to give up their salaries, especially if you figure in the loss to medical and nursing schools and industry linked to academic medical centers, asking for me? Dan?
There would be a cut under most of these proposals. That's one way that they would be financed. Again, taxes would be increased, but there would also be this cut in pay, partly because of those crazy bills that you just mentioned, Joshua, that prices in the United States are so high because there is not a single price-setting entity. If a giant Medicare for All type plan existed that had the influence to set prices lower, that would have trickle-down effects. And it's been interesting to watch doctors and nurses grapple with that.
Well, that would seem to disincentivize people from wanting to go into medicine. I mean, some medical schools like UC Davis out near Sacramento, California, have been experimenting with making medical school a 3-year program instead of a 4-year program because it's so insanely expensive and you don't dig out of that debt for years until you're like, you know, you've gone through your boards and you've gone through your residency, the whole thing. It could solve one problem but cause another.
There would be ramifications. There are a lot of good middle class, upper class jobs in healthcare right now. Being a nurse, it's a pathway to the middle class. Being a doctor, even with all that medical debt, can still be a very well-paying job. So yes, it would change some of the incentives there, but I would say that 40% less for a doctor is still considerably more than the average American gets paid.
Charlotte tweeted, are politicians really worried about people overusing healthcare? We should be encouraging everyone to access care. My brother didn't go to a doctor for 10 years. He was diagnosed with diabetes and other things. He died 6 months later. He was 37 years old. Before we go, what does the political reality in this country have to look like for anything approximating what our listener asked about, Doug, to even begin to come to pass? Dan, what is the political path forward for anything like this?
Well, the political path is going to look a little bit like the Affordable Care Act fight. The committees would have to come up with legislation that would have to make its way through the separate chambers of Congress. There needs to be a president who would sign that into law. As we sit here in January 2019, this, again, looks like a multi-year process, but Senator Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren could be the president who on day one says, let's do this.
And Julie, it's worth noting what Joseph wrote. Joseph tweeted, Obamacare was supposed to fix all this, and still you say 30 million people are uninsured or underinsured. Why in the world should I embrace the idea of more government control over health care? Julie, before we go.
Well, and I think to answer your first question, I think what's really needed is a better educational process. And thank you for doing this, because this is the beginning of the discussion that needs to be had. Obamacare was not intended to fix everything. It was intended to fix some things, and it did fix some things, and it broke others. And, you know, Congress has not really, normally Congress would have adjusted as they went and the Republicans took over and that didn't happen. But I think definitely, you know, in order to get to a change of this magnitude, everybody, both parties, the public, are going to have to be on board.
Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News and Dan Diamond of Politico. This program was produced by James Morrison and Paige Osborne and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.